Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
African Union released a statement.
Hold on 1 second. There's something playing in the background. Of course there is. Give me 1 second.
All right.
Okay, let's try again. I'll be super quick because I know you have a meeting. Let's just start at the top by having you introduce yourself and tell me about your organization. Start there.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, I'm Adam Van Noord, the director of the Multicultural Community Center, which is a branch office of the Ethiopian Community Development Council, one of 9 refugee resettlement organizations in the U.S. And we are a new office in Wausau, Wisconsin, which was recently vetted by the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration to do resettlement in this community. And so we're starting off with the initial 75 Afghans that were approved to resettle, but expect this to be a long-term, you know, permanent office, which will engage refugees from around the world in the years to come.
Talk about some of the things that you're doing to help the first 75 arrive and kind of what is necessary, what you're doing and what you're counting on the community to help you do.
Well, we're mandated to provide a number of core services as part of our cooperative agreement with the federal government. And so within those core services are things that we handle directly as an office in terms of case management, you know, pairing them with local service providers and ensuring, you know, safety and wellness and, you know, setting them up on their path toward integration. That's our mission. But to do that, we obviously have to leverage all of the local resources and service providers in our community. So in terms of preparation, we've been having a lot of dialogue, making sure people in the community who provide things like, you know, public benefit enrollment, education, healthcare services, literacy, transportation, education for job skills, all of these people who are already doing great things to serve our community members, understand the population that we're working with and the uniquenesses of providing services for them. So that's been happening for the last couple of months. And besides that, we anticipate certain challenges, one being housing and then a second being interpretation due to the fact that Afghans don't exist in Wausau, Wisconsin. We don't have a, you know, people to draw from for in-person interpretation. So for housing, we've been looking at a number of models that other, you know, communities have been using around the nation. One is, you know, looking at transitional housing, knowing that when we reach our peak volume of individuals arriving, it's going to become increasingly difficult to find affordable long-term apartments for them to move right into. The inventory just isn't going to be there. So transitional housing includes things like extended stay hotels, you know, working with Airbnb and their generous offer to, you know, basically subsidize or offer reduced rates for refugees for short term. We're looking at large group housing facilities where we could comfortably house up to 15 or 20 people with common living spaces, common dining areas. Again, it would be short term, but give us a little bit more time to secure apartments in the event that many people arrive at once. The last thing we're doing as far as housing procurement is getting some funding together to actually start renting homes now that are available, holding them essentially and having the chance to furnish them, get them completely, you know, move-in ready, and maintaining an inventory of 5 or 6 places at any given time. to reduce that bottleneck as well. As far as interpretation goes, lastly, we have an online service provider that is able to provide on-demand Dari and Pashto, which is the two primary languages that we expect these groups to come with. And we also have been in touch with some Afghans who are citizens who've been residing in the US and are willing to provide web-based interpretation via Zoom or another virtual platform.
I love it. It sounds like you're really like thinking outside the box, and maybe the pandemic makes it even easier to come up with an idea like using the web as a mode of interpretation.
Yeah, you have to be creative. I mean, the challenges we're facing, you know, the ideal solution isn't always apparent, but there are ways, there are workarounds. And at the end of the day, we expect there's going to be bumps. There's going to be hiccups. There's going to be things that maybe aren't handled the way we would have hoped. But ultimately, if we can make sure they're safe, secure, you know, obviously housed, fed, that's number one. You know, everything else is you know, we'll work with what we have.
Okay, cool. I spoke yesterday with a refugee who came here in, gosh, the late 80s, I believe, and so now she's really involved in helping. And one of the primary things she's trying to do in the Bay is connect local Afghan families with other Afghan families who could co-sign their lease, or she's connecting them with Afghan doctors. And I'm like, okay, well, in Wisconsin, they don't have a big population to draw from, but are you looking for doctors to step up to say, okay, I'll take these patients? And, you know, in addition to the housing that you're looking at, will it cover it, or will you potentially need maybe a local family to consider co-signing, or what other like local needs might you have on that front?
Yeah, so we're working with a pilot project called the co-sponsorship model. And that is a way for self-organized groups of volunteers to be paired formally with a family. And so they actually will sign an MOU, you know, a memorandum of understanding, to ensure that, you know, they understand all of the things that family needs as they integrate in the community. And so it's a 9-month commitment on the part of the volunteers to that family to provide, you know, guidance, support, advocacy, transportation, networking them, helping them to, you know, facilitate appointments. And we work very closely as an agency with those groups in tandem. So they're actually providing many of the core services that we would do anyway. But the advantage is that, you know, that group, you know, collectively represents a lot of resources, you know, social capital. They have knowledge of individuals in the community, they have knowledge of employment opportunities. And so by matching groups with families in this way, it's shown that it can really expedite the integration process. And a second component of that arrangement is that each co-sponsorship group raises a minimum of $3,000. And that $3,000 goes into an account through ECDC. We manage it, and it provides additional funding to cover rent or other unexpected needs that might come up along the way. As far as like, you know, co-signing, our desire is for these families to feel empowered and to stand up on their own. So we actually are proposing that leases are signed in the name of the head of household. And we come alongside them to ensure that, you know, as much community resources as is available gets passed along to them so that they can, you know, really own that responsibility.
I love that.
Back to your point about, you know, again, we do expect at some point along the way, there's going to be, you know, an obvious housing shortage. And in other communities, while it's not the first, you know, it's not the primary, it's not preferable, we do expect at some point to open it up for local families to house individuals if needed. It's kind of like a plan C, I guess. But in other communities, families who are empty nesters or maybe have a lower level of, you know, of their residence that they're not using, a lot of those types of situations tend to present themselves. And if that's the case, then we will consider that as a third option.
Adam, I'm actually really glad we're doing this interview over because we're going deeper into like the specifics of what you're doing. And so this is really good. What kind of
community? The last time you talked to me, I had kids running around, so I was having trouble focusing.
Oh, it's okay. I often have the same challenge. I'm just praying mine stay in bed a little longer. Yeah. Right now. So what else did I want to ask you? Oh yeah. Tell me how many co-sponsors you have signed up right now. And how many more you need? What can people do to jump in?
Yeah, I think we have about 16 groups in the pipeline, and that could mean, you know, a couple of people reached out and said, hey, they're interested in doing this. And maybe that's where the status of that group is. And all the way over to groups who are fully formed, they've gone through our planning documents, they've turned in applications, they're submitting background checks. So they're at the very end of their approval process. There is quite a preparation process that we have to ensure that these groups are competent and really set up for success.
Once they're approved, give me an overview of that, really quick.
Yeah. So what we're looking for is people who are self-organized. They have their own initiative. They're forming their own groups. This isn't a system where individuals come to us in ones and twos and we're like building teams like a roster. That's really not the way the model is intended to work. We're looking at naturally occurring social groups that already exist, whether family, work-related, faith communities, civic organizations. So people who are already, they already know each other. They're already working together. And we find that it's just best that way because they tend to gel more and things move a lot more smoothly. So these types of, you know, groups are coming to us, and, you know, once they indicate that they have at least, you know, a few members and are actively recruiting, then we'll put them on our list and start giving them guidance on how to really think this through. So we have a planning worksheet that takes about 3 hours to go through as a group. It prompts a lot of questions, a lot of things that people might not consider, you know, on the front end to really help them to think through all the different aspects of what this commitment really looks like. At the end of that, once they've gone through that planning worksheet and they've identified different roles within that group, then they would submit an application to us. They have to have a minimum of 7 members. So the 7 members each correspond to a needed role along with a group leader. So there's one group leader, and then you have a bunch of committees essentially where transportation, education, healthcare, jobs and finance. What's the other ones?
Maybe medical or some, I mean.
Yeah. Every committee member kind of leads an area of responsibility.
And is it per family, or is it, does one sponsor group take on several families?
No. I mean, they can do this over and over again, but during the time of their commitment, they're matched with a single family. So some groups will have 7, they'll meet that minimum. Other groups that we're working with have 15 people in their group. And so they've defined kind of those core lead people, but then they have extra support people who can jump in as needed to support. So
that's so cool. And then because we're also covering the initiative that Vino Latte is doing to try to support, are you familiar with what they're doing?
I'm not. What more?
That's so interesting. I assumed when I was assigned this story that you all were interconnected. They have a giving tree and people can take something off.
Sure.
Tree, yeah. They either get maybe they go get a gift certificate for Quick Trip, or they get cookie,
awesome.
yeah, that kind of thing.
So that's an initiative through a local organization called New Beginnings for Refugees, which I mentioned last time. We're collaborating closely with them.
And I will not be able to talk to them for this article. So can you just tell me a little, because my deadline is right around the corner and I haven't heard back. Yeah. So can you just briefly tell me, you know, a little bit about them and the project based on what you're aware of?
Yeah, definitely. New Beginnings for Refugees is a fiscal sponsorship of the Community Foundation of North Central Wisconsin. So Community Foundation took them under their umbrella to provide like funding and a platform for local donors to contribute to refugee integration. So New Beginnings is handling volunteer mobilization and recruitment. They're handling a donation drive through various sites. The Giving Tree that you mentioned is it something that they developed to solicit specific material type needs that refugees are expected to have. And they're just a big collaborator in the community. They're trying to just initiate a lot of discussion and get people active and involved in this process. Another area is education and awareness. So New Beginnings is working with other groups to spearhead public forums, either virtual or in person, where we can continue to have, you know, positive, constructive discussion around this topic and help people understand what does this mean for Wausau long-term to have, you know, dozens and someday potentially hundreds of refugees resettling in this community.
Okay, and I'm sure you're almost out of time. So in the short term, what do you think is the opportunity that's here? And make the pitch to people from Wausau who are still scratching their head and trying to make sense of it. Why is this important? What does it have the potential to do to the community from your vantage point?
Yeah, I mean, we really want to appeal to people's compassion and again, encourage everyone to understand that these people they're humans with human needs, just like we all have. As much as there may be cultural differences and different faith backgrounds and you know, different political, you know, orientations, whatever those differences might be, they really pale in comparison to the need that these people are coming with to be viewed as you know, human. And they want the same things that we want. So I'm encouraging people to really see this as an opportunity to step in at a really critical time in history. You know, our forces, our government was involved in Afghanistan for 20 years officially. And these individuals, the majority of them, the vast majority, are in some way connected to the supports that our military and our government received on the ground in Afghanistan. So they're coming here now in their time of need. And I think it's a perfect chance for us to just express our gratitude, but also just to demonstrate what it looks like to respond, you know, with compassion in these circumstances.
I love that. And I already can glean what you mean when you say they want and need the same things that we do, but it will sound beautiful if it's in your words as my interviewee. So when you say they want and need the same things as Americans, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, what we're hearing directly from the bases is the primary concern from these individuals is the welfare of their children. They want their children in school. They want to know that they're going to be safe. Living in a military base, we don't know what that looks like unless you have that in your background, in your experience. But you can imagine being surrounded by a bunch of strangers and in an unfamiliar context. It's very uncomfortable what these people are experiencing right now. And just as we would want to ensure the safety and welfare of our children, that's their primary concern. Second to that, they want opportunity. You know, they want to rebuild their lives. They're coming having lost everything, having left everything behind. And who wouldn't want, you know, a chance to rebuild, you know, to reestablish their lives and restore hope for their family?
Beautiful. What else do you want to add?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that pretty much sums it up. I think the last thing I guess, you know, if there's a way to add this into the message to our community, it's good to keep in mind that the circumstances of the Afghan resettlement are not typical for refugee resettlement. There's an urgency surrounding this particular group, which is unique. Normally, refugee resettlement has a more sustainable cadence, and you know, it's a long-term effort that has, you know, many steps involved. And so an office like ours would be seeing more manageable numbers coming into the community throughout the year. With the Afghan crisis, there's a lot more urgency, a lot more pressure to get these individuals housed. And so, you know, our community is going to see this influx, and it's going to be very busy and perhaps chaotic initially as we all kind of adjust and accommodate the various needs. But, you know, again, we're looking long term at resettling individuals from around the world, Congolese, Burmese, Syrians. And as we reach as we begin refugee resettlement on those fronts, it's going to feel a lot more manageable, I think, as a community as well.
And then lastly, just because this word, you know, last time we talked more about this, but the word parolee has a lot more maybe stigma attached to it than refugee. So can you talk to people about why folks have the parolee kind of title right now and and what that means?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if you're like me and a lot of people, parolee has a strong connotation of the criminal justice system. So that's unfortunate, because even though that is the official term that the, you know, from an immigration standpoint, that is their status, Afghan parolee. It has nothing to do with their, you know, with the quality of their character. So what that's referring to is the sense that, you know, they were evacuated in a time of urgency, in a period of crisis. And so the vetting that normally takes, you know, months and years and occurs overseas through various partner agencies ended up happening here in the U.S. At the bases. And so Afghans who are coming under the current legislation are given the Afghan parolee status, meaning that they've been fully vetted. You know, there's 8 or 9 agencies, U.S. federal agencies, that were all involved in ensuring that these individuals check out, that they're safe. And during their time in the U.S., they have, you know, upon arrival, they have 2 years to change their adjustment of status from Afghan parolee to asylum seeker. And unless there's you know, new legislation introduced in the months and years to come, that is the end game. There is no path to citizenship currently available to these individuals. However, once they have their asylee status, you know, they'll have the ability to live, you know, legally in this country, they'll be able to work, you know, and of course the children that are born will be, you know, full U.S. citizens, just like any other group or individual born in the U.S. But yeah, that's essentially a specific immigration status for this group that was designated.
And for those who don't make it into the asylum seeker status, what happens?
I mean, yeah, that's if there is some cause for concern, or if something doesn't check out for an individual, then I suppose, you know, all options are on the table, whether that's, you know, being diverted or deported back to their country of origin. I don't believe that's a very common outcome whatsoever. But yeah, so everyone that's here currently, and I'll emphasize too, that everybody that exits the safe havens are leaving with an employment authorization document So even with the Afghan parolee status, they're legal residents. They're just not legal permanent residents yet. And they have the ability to pursue employment. You know, they have all of the rights and privileges that other residents have.
Okay, cool. I want to be respectful of your time. Is there anything else that you want to add before we conclude?
I'm really happy that you're seeking the perspectives of the Afghans who are at the bases. And I really hope that, you know, your communication with Mr. Azad, it goes well. And I think he's a phenomenal voice that you can really, you know, just provide that perspective with in your writing, in your journalism. I think those are the stories that are most important. You know, we can share our perspectives as an agency all day long and what we hope to accomplish, but at the end of the day, hearing from these people and understanding, you know, their needs, their hopes, the challenges they've faced, I really hope that has a front and center place in journalism going forward.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm intending to pitch. I think this is something that we should continue to kind of lift up these voices throughout even the year. So I think
absolutely.
Thank you for taking the time to do this twice with me. For people, like, of course, I know these aren't Adam's policies that you're clarifying. They are U.S. government.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. All right. Well, thank you. Have a great day.
Yep. Sounds good. Thanks, you too.
All right. Bye-bye.